Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. To further confuse you into thinking that it is Monday, it's not. It's Tuesday. It's Tuesday. It's 2 for Tuesday. And you want to get your requests in for 2 for Tuesday? Yeah. You can do that, 312-981-7200. But I know when you hear the familiar theme from the movie review segment, you think, well, it's got to be Monday morning because it's the Monday morning movie reviews. But we were off yesterday for Memorial Day, and we're back this morning. Now, Colin and Eric are taking another day off because they had an incredibly crazy week at the Music Box with the Chicago Film Critics Festival, which was a roaring success. And they'll tell us about that next week when they're back. But Jim Leskowski, our old buddy who filled in for Colin for a couple of months at the beginning of the year and has filled in on occasion here and there, is kind enough to join us to help me review the new movies. We will talk about box office as well here on a Tuesday morning. So it is the Tuesday morning movie reviews, and let's welcome Jim to the show. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Nick. It's good to be on once again. I got to say, with all the hard work and great films that Colin and Eric and the rest of the crew put together, they deserve some much-needed rest, man.
Yeah, I mean, well, they were essentially at the Music Box for like a week straight. Like they barely left the place, and you know, and I guess they had a really good turnout for the films. They had a great closing night, and I guess Colin's short festival, his short programs that ran twice during the festival itself, were both very successful. And so it's good. I'm glad for those guys, and so they're gonna chill out, and then they'll be back next week to review some of the new movies. So Jim, tell everybody about NowPlayingNetwork.net, and that you host a podcast on there called Directors Club, and you were kind enough to ask me to be on with you a couple of weeks ago, and that podcast is up right now, and it's us discussing Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, that was a blast. You know, for podcasts out there that, you know, are sort of covering the wide range of entertainment, and you got a lot of music-centric podcasts and movie-centric podcasts, it's easy to get lost in how many exist at this point. But I really wanted to contribute and put together a network because I've talked with and have heard so many talented people that I felt deserved their own show and to get their voice out there. And this wide spectrum of shows range from Vinyl Emergency with Jim Hankey, who recently had a really great interview with one of the minds behind Vinyl Me Please, which is a great service that sort of sends you like a vinyl record in the mail, if I recall. And Eric Childress's movie Madness, which took a little break too due to all the hard work that Eric has put into his own festival. And supporting characters from Bill Ackerman, who just also put out a new episode today as well. But my own show, Directors Club, just put out an epic episode with my former co-host as a guest. And we pretty much covered the entire filmography from Spike Lee. Mm. I mean, it took 3.5 hours, but we did it.
Yeah.
And I think the only movie we differed on was Bamboozled, but we came to the conclusion that Spike Lee has made 3 masterpieces, and it was an absolute blast for us to talk about Spike Lee on Directors Club. So for that and more, go to NowPlayingNetwork.net.
Okay. And the 3 masterpieces, my guess, would be 25th Hour, Do the Right Thing, and
Malcolm X.
Malcolm X. Oh, okay. Good
yeah.
choice. Okay. All right, cool. Yeah. And also, NowPlayingNetwork.net for all the information for all those podcasts. And it's a really cool thing, so support it. We have a link on our Facebook page at Facebook.com/NickDShow. You sent me a note earlier this week about a podcast guest and a friend of yours named Dan Solomon.
Oh, yeah.
Could you care to tell everybody about that?
Yeah, well, he was on – I have a spinoff show called Pop Culture Club, and we did an episode – you know, probably a week ago, about our favorite records of 1996. We sort of just went back in time and talked about like a seminal year in our lives in which the arts kind of shaped us in some way. And, you know, we had a great time talking for like 90 minutes about music. And then a couple days later, something incredible happened for Dan. He covered this story about Baylor University I believe it was in August, he published a piece that actually went on to win awards for the kind of journalism that him and his collaborator, Jessica Luther, did. And Baylor University confirmed on Thursday that the football coach had been fired after an independent investigation found that the university had completely mishandled multiple rape allegations, mostly against football players. And Ken Starr, the university's president, and he's also the same Ken Starr from the Bill Clinton scandal, is also stepping down from his position. And this is due in large part to the investigation that Dan Solomon and Jessica Luther did. They did a lot of hard work. This is almost done like Spotlight. They conducted interviews, went through court documents, did extensive research on what was going on, what was being swept under the rug at Baylor. And the article they put out last August is responsible for bringing this issue to light. And a lot was done as a result. So, you know, all this was brought to everyone's attention in the faculty, and, you know, the police got involved, and just a huge investigation occurred. So much has happened, and I could not be more proud to call Dan my friend. I've known him since high school, and he's a great writer, and look what happened.
That's amazing. That really is an incredible story.
I'm still taken aback every time I talk about it with people.
Wow, Ken Starr, man. That's a big deal, obviously.
Yeah.
Boy, when was the last time we heard Ken Starr's name? And remember when it was mentioned every 15 minutes back in like 1998?
Yes, of course. So,
that's really amazing. And Dan Solomon, and he was a journalist. It's for the Texas Monthly?
Correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that article came out in August, and a lot has happened as a result of that. And it's an issue that gets swept under the rug and is actually covered very, very well. And I believe it's Kirby Dix.
Yeah.
I believe he directed The Hunting Ground.
He did, yeah, which is a terrific film.
Yeah. So that movie just packed a wallop when I saw it. And, you know, knowing that something was being done in such a proactive and productive manner recently at Baylor University is just great to discover. There's still a lot of work to be done in that area, but we'll keep people posted on this story because it's ongoing. It's interesting.
All right, cool, Jim. Hang on, okay?
All right.
Jim Laskowski is with us, and he is going to be filling in for Colin Eric, who, again, taking another week off in lieu of that insanely busy and popular film critic festival that took place just this past week. All right, we got some big movies to talk about. We'll talk about the box office as well. 312-981-7200. It is Tuesday. Don't be confused. Two for Tuesday. If you want to get your Two for Tuesday requests in, you can do that as well. We'll take a break for the news, and after the news, we'll come back and start afresh with the new movies and the movie reviews right here on WGN. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6. It is Tuesday. Yes, it is. Two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. We are doing the movie reviews this morning. We were off yesterday for Memorial Day, and that means my dad will also call and tell a joke to further confuse you into thinking that it's Monday. So, but my dad will call in a little bit later on this Tuesday morning. He'll tell the joke, and we got the movie reviews. And we're also going to be talking about crazy neighbor stories. We haven't done this in a while, but we've all had wacky neighbors. We've all had weird neighbors. We've all got stories in our lives about neighbors that we had to put up with. So we'll get to those stories as well. And, but let's get back to the movie reviews. Jim Laskowski is filling in for Colin and Eric, who are taking another week off. They'll be back next week. They just had that big event at the Music Box, the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and it went very well. So they're taking another week off. But Jim is here to help us review the movies. Okay, Jim, welcome back.
Hello again.
All right. I understand that you did not see Tale of Tales.
I did not. I didn't get a chance to, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, let me...
I am curious about it, though.
Well, I'll tell you really quickly about it. It's it's an anthology film that tells different fairy tales or different stories, very much like Grimm's fairy tales. They're very, very dark, and they're very, very twisted. And they're inspired by an Italian writer, and this is the English language debut of an Italian filmmaker named, what's his name again? I have to look this up. Matteo Garrone. And it's based on these books by Basile, who was very much the Grimm's fairy tale writer of that time period. And it's about kingdoms and queens and stuff like that. And it's filled with weird creatures and crazy special effects. It is a gorgeously shot movie. The production design is amazing. The sets are pretty cool. The cast includes Salma Hayek, who is it's one of her craziest performance. It's a very fierce, strong, crazy role. One of the most startling images in the movie is of her just eating the giant heart of a creature that was just killed while she's in this beautiful gown, but blood all over her face and this giant bloody heart sitting in front of her. And that's the kind of imagery that's in the movie. Vincent Cassell is in it. Toby Jones is in it. Very briefly, John C. Reilly, who plays Salma Hayek's husband, the king. There are several other actors and actresses in the film. It is a feast for the eyes. I will say that it is a movie that is beautifully shot, and there's a lot of imagination going on in the film. Really startlingly weird creatures and interesting special effects. The performances are kind of inconsistent in terms of tone. Like, Salma Hayek is pretty fierce throughout the entire movie. Vincent Cassell is always great. Toby Jones is a little bit over the top. John C. Reilly, very funny and briefly in the movie. The problem with the movie is also what I just said about the performances. The tone is pretty inconsistent. This is definitely an R-rated film. It's the kind of dark, twisted fairy tale stuff that you don't normally hear about, or the kind of stuff that we grew up hearing about. A lot of the fairy tales, Jim, in our culture in America, they've been sanitized over the years. I mean, they're really twisted and very, very dark and really screwed up in a lot of ways. And they still kind of remain that way. But the origin stories, the way that some of the classic fairy tales were really originally told, were pretty twisted and pretty screwed up. This is like that. The problem is that it's inconsistent in tone. Sometimes they go for laughs. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's taken very seriously. Other times it's taken really over the top. So that inconsistent peak and valley in terms of tone ultimately undermine the film, which, as I said, has some pretty cool performances and technically is pretty great. I can't quite recommend it, although if you're looking to see something that is original, I can tell you that. I mean, there's not a ton of original things out there. I mean, the two big movies that we're reviewing this week in the theaters are both sequels. So if you're looking for something that's startlingly original, you could do a lot worse than Tale of Tales. It's just a little bit inconsistent. It's a little long, too. It's over 2 hours, and it could have been trimmed by 10, 15 minutes, and it would have been tighter and perhaps a little bit better. And maybe the tone wouldn't have been so glaring had they sharpened it up a little bit. I do recommend, if you're a Salma Hayek fan, and I am a big Salma Hayek fan, this is a really crazy performance by her, and she does some stuff in here that's a lot of fun to watch. So if you're into weird sort of fantasy, horror, sci-fi, fairy tale kind of a thing, you could do worse. It's not great. It's not bad either. I'm somewhere in between on it. So that's Tale of Tales. It's playing at the Siskel Center in Chicago, but is also available on the On Demand, and that's how I watched it, on Demand. So, Tale of Tales.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I mean, when you talk about, like fantastical, like folk myths or fairy tales, it kind of reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite examples of that, and that's Neil Jordan's The Company of Wolves.
Yeah, great movie.
Sort of taking that spin on the Little Red Riding Hood tale and just making it way darker and creepier and interesting.
Yeah, no, that's a great example, and that is a movie that is, that's a great example of doing it the right way. That was a movie that was, like most of Neil Jordan's movies, pretty consistent in tone and everything and really well done. So that's a good one, In the Company of Wolves. Okay, cool. So that's Tale of Tales. And Jim, you saw a movie that neither of us saw. Oh, no, neither of us. No, you saw a movie that, somehow magically you saw a movie that nobody else saw. No, you saw a movie that I didn't see called Maggie's Plan. And I'm interested in this. It's Rebecca Miller, her latest movie. And that's Arthur Miller's daughter and Daniel Day-Lewis's wife.
Correct. She made a really interesting, I believe it was her debut with Personal Velocity, which, again, it's kind of like one of those movies with three different stories in it that I thought was very strong. And I mean, the acting in that especially kind of blew me away. And I know you're a fan of Fairuza Balk, for example.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I just remember really being taken with her debut, and I actually have not caught up with a couple of other films since. But I was definitely curious about this, mainly because of the cast. And in this we have Maggie, played by Greta Gerwig, and she is a woman in her late 20s and determined to conceive a child all on her own. She is set out to find a sperm donor, but on that journey she stumbles across a rather charismatic writer and professor named John, played by Ethan Hawke, and they develop a good rapport and, you know, good chemistry right off the bat. And without very much consideration, and, you know, they just hit it off so quickly, they find themselves pretty much in love, you know, right out of the gate. And sort of overlooking the fact that John happens to be married with two children, and John is married to Georgette, played by Julianne Moore, who is also an acclaimed writer and someone that John can sort of match wits and intelligence with in a different way than he can with Maggie. Georgette is obviously upset about the affair, but she surprisingly tries to stay cordial just to keep the relationship thriving. But John wants to write his novel, and Maggie wants to, you know, conceive the child and hopefully have everything work out. But eventually we cut to 3 years later, and Maggie has grown tired of John and decides he would be much better off with his ex-wife. So in an interesting turn of events, her plan is to essentially reunite the formerly married couple in hopes that they will rekindle their passion and get back together. So yeah, a few times on my podcast, I brought up how certain directors at some point in their careers want to make their own spin on like a Hitchcock movie or a Sidney Lumet movie. But if you think about how many different filmmakers sort of set out to make their own version of a Woody Allen movie, that's probably just as frequent. I was interested in this because of the three lead actors. I enjoy watching all of them, even if I kind of heard that it's a straightforward romantic comedy. And I think maybe Rebecca Miller, she tried to recreate like the screwball comedy and filter it through maybe the mismatched lover setup of something like A Midsummer Night's Dream. But I think really the only reason to watch this is for the charm of the actors rather than getting caught up in the story and whether any of them wind up fulfilled. And, you know, as much as I like Gerwig and Ethan Hawke's chemistry, once again, kind of a big saving grace here is Julianne Moore, who between this and Maps to the Stars should kind of keep doing these like strange, surreal comedic characters. Here she has like a quirky German accent, but at the same time, she does manage to wring genuine emotion in a way that only Julianne Moore can do gracefully. There's some good dialogue here that wouldn't have been out of place in like the last few Noah Baumbach movies. But, you know, like I said, there's a lot to enjoy. There's some good bit parts by Maya Rudolph and Bill Hader as, you know, bickering married friends. But by the end, it sort of came across as just like a little bit too precious. And, you know, the ground cover here has been covered much better and done before, including in Gerwig's work with Baumbach, like Greenberg and Frances Ha. So there's not a whole lot to take away once it's over. Nothing very memorable about this outside of maybe a moment involving the lead singer of Bikini Kill, the former lead singer of Bikini Kill, singing experimental tribal music at a work retreat, of all things. So that was a nice moment. But it's not a time waster. Like, if it pops up on Netflix or Amazon Prime down the road, it's worth a look, but I just wouldn't rush out to see it because it really is just a serviceable romantic comedy And it has its charms, but that's mainly just due to the cast rather than the story itself. So okay. It's just okay.
All right. That's Maggie's Plan, which is playing in theaters in Chicago. It's the latest from Rebecca Miller. Okay, we got to take a break here. Jim, hang on.
Alrighty,
and when we come back, we've got more movies to review. A couple of big ones that came out this week as well. And then we got box office. We'll go through the numbers, tell you what were the winners and the losers at the box office this weekend. Again, it is Tuesday, not to confuse everybody. I know we normally do this on Monday. It's the Tuesday morning movie reviews right here on 720 WGN, and they will continue after we take a break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower with the Tuesday morning movie reviews. Eric and Colin again taking another week off to recuperate from the very successful and very busy Chicago Critics Film Festival that took place last week at the Music Box. They'll be back next week. Jim Liskowski filling in for them. You can check out his podcasts at nowplayingnetwork.net. And we have a link on our Facebook page. And we have a link to the one that I appear on from a few weeks ago. We taped it. It's now up. And you can check it out. It's a podcast where Jim and I discuss the first part of Martin Scorsese's career. We only got the Goodfellas, so we'll have to do part two soon. And Jim is back. Welcome back, Jim.
Alrighty.
Okay. I will be full disclosure, Jim. The movie that we are about to review, I made it 33 minutes into it before I turned it off. And let me just say this, the Ridiculous Six was the first movie that Adam Sandler made exclusively for Netflix. This one, The Do-Over, is the second. I made it through 41 minutes of The Ridiculous Six. So,
I'm sensing a pattern here.
Yeah, and it's one of these things where, I watched this movie on my phone, and it seems appropriate that Adam Sandler now makes movies that you can watch on your phone. That seems to be the way he's headed and the way he should be headed. It's hard to believe there was a time when I really liked Adam Sandler, because I liked him on SNL. I thought he was funny on Remote Control. And his first couple of movies, especially Happy Gilmore, are very funny. But this guy hasn't done anything good in years and years and years and years and years. I mean, this has just been bad stuff. So, Jim, I'm assuming you watched the whole thing. Okay, well, tell everybody about The Do-Over. This is Adam Sandler and David Spade's latest for Netflix.
Oh, boy. Well, here we have the character of Charlie, who we're introduced to early on, who is at his high school reunion watching his wife dirty dancing with her ex-husband on the dance floor. And in the middle of this very uncomfortable moment, he bumps into an old high school pal named Max, played by Adam Sandler. And the two childhood...
Yeah, and his name tag. His name tag says MaxiPad. Hilarious.
That's the humor you're going to get here.
Yeah.
So they take some time to catch up, and Max reveals that he is actually in the FBI. Later, he invites Charlie to sort of get away and party on his boat, and two men have a great time. And then suddenly, the boat explodes, and Max tells Charlie that they are officially dead as they drive off. So the two men take on the identities of a couple of murdered men that Max says he had just found. They find some money and a mansion in Puerto Rico where they move to, probably because Adam Sandler decided he needed to take another vacation.
Yeah.
And, after a few identity changes on Max's part and an attack by a small group of assassins, they obviously change their names and do all these things. But they also want to learn why their new identities, the people that they've stolen these identities from, were murdered, all while trying to keep one step ahead of the killers. And, oh, boy. So the Do-Over it becomes the usual substandard Sandler film, and it actually tries to incorporate this substantial idea and plot, as well as like an attempt to inject sympathy for these morons, and we have no reason to care. nothing at all makes you want to root for these guys. You just begin to question, why is this worth an hour and 50 minutes of your time? Well, you're hoping to laugh. And much like the rest of Sandler's recent films, you're not going to. There's just nothing redeemable here. Like you mentioned, just the maxi pad joke. That's the kind of comedy I'm expecting from Sandler these days, and that's really sad. It seems like every week we have a lowbrow comedy that seems to think that vulgarity just automatically leads to hilarity, and that's just not true. You know, the thing is like, even in the Farrelly Brothers movies, you actually care about the people you're spending time with, even if they're selfish and dumb. And particularly those first three Farrelly Brothers movies, they just found the perfect balance of, you know, ridiculous humor and heart.
Yeah, and, you know, in a movie like 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, they fit into that category, especially 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yeah, no, for sure. But Sandler he's got like homophobic jokes, misogynistic jokes, and they're offensive. You don't laugh, you cringe. You know, there's a scene early on when Sandler asks girls on a boat to flash them, and then David Spade returns the favor by taking down his pants, only to be ridiculed, and Sandler decides to throw stuff or something that knocks the girls off the boat, and right. that's just ridiculous. That's the level of humor that Sandler has resorted to time and time again, and it's just, this is kind of his attempt to make a buddy comedy. But it's just a depressing experience. As it goes on, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And the more that I hope Sandler is going to redeem himself, I'm just let down at each time. So this is just, again, another terrible movie in a long line of terrible movies from him and his production company. And like you, I was a fan of especially his first three films. And there's nothing redeemable about the do-over whatsoever. It was a chore to get through.
Well, I didn't even get through it. Like I said, I turned it off. And I mean, it's just desperate and unfunny, and the jokes are cheap. And there's a real, you know, because the budgets are lower on these Netflix movies, and because you can watch them like on your, you know, on your tablet or your phone or whatever. They have a much cheaper feel to them. So I'm thinking to myself, how is it possible to make an Adam Sandler movie worse? Well, take away the budget and watch it on a phone. And, you know, I mean, that just adds to the how pathetic these movies are. And you're absolutely right about the tone. I mean, you know, Natasha Leggero, who is one of my favorite stand-up comedians, I think she's hilarious, is so wasted in this movie. And her character, like right out of the gate, you want to talk about misogyny, the first scene in the movie. Just this really horrible woman, and none of it's funny, and it's, you know, like the hatred that is thrown upon and thrust upon this really horribly written, one-dimensional, misogynistic character, that sets the tone for the entire, at least first 30-some minutes of the movie that I watched. Sandler is coasting. He's trying to be like tough guy in this. And I'm assuming as it went on, the action probably built up and they were trying to do like an action comedy, shoot him up kind of a thing. Spade is just, you know, like I've never been a huge fan of David Spade, but like here's another one of these characters that he's playing that's supposed to be, you know, pathetic and sad. I didn't even get to see a lot of the cameos that you know, the usual suspects who show up in the Sandler movies make. So
Luis Guzman, for example, and that's just, that's just sad to see.
Yeah. The do-over, it's horrible. I didn't even make it through the whole thing. It's available on Netflix, where now Sandler is sort of exclusively making movies, and I think that's fine because you can turn him off without hurting anyone's feelings. Okay.
That's true. I feel bad for the guy in some ways, just because, like, maybe he, you know, like his attempts – I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, he tried with like The Cobbler and Men, Women, and Children to do something a little bit more dramatic,
right.
And those were bad too.
Yeah, no.
And maybe he just said, well, maybe I should just go back to the well and
Well, that's clearly what he's doing. He's, you know, he's got himself a multi-million-dollar deal with Netflix and he's just churning out crap. That's basically what he's doing. Okay, Jim, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. Jim Liskowski is here. We've got two big movies to review right after we take a break for the news. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It is Tuesday. That means it's 2 for Tuesday coming up. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday, yeah. Get your requests in, 312-981-7200. You guys, you, the listeners, are responsible for programming all the musical bumps that we play coming back from commercials and breaks. And it's your choice. So 2 for Tuesday today. Two songs by an artist. 312-981-7200. We're doing the Tuesday morning movie reviews. We were off yesterday for Memorial Day. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke, just like it was on a Monday, but it's really Tuesday. He'll be calling in to tell a joke. We're also going to talk about crazy neighbor stories. We've all had them. We've all had to deal with lunatic neighbors and crazy neighbors, and I would love to hear your stories. We haven't done it in a long time, but we're going to get into that a little bit later on as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Check us out at facebook.com/Nick D Show, which is the best way to stay connected. And check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show as well. Okay. Jim Leskowski, who is sitting in for Colin and Eric, who are taking another week off. They'll be back next week, is helping us out to review the movies. And Jim, welcome back.
Hello there again. I hope you do bring up your CB radio neighbors.
Yes. Those were a couple of the craziest neighbors I've ever lived next to. I lived the apartment right next to these people. And
that's a good story.
Yeah, we'll get to that one a little bit later on. Okay, Jim, tell us about X-Men Apocalypse.
Okay, I think I can do that. So the story takes place about 10 years after Days of Future Past, which might very well be my favorite in the entire franchise, actually, the last one.
I think the last two have been the strongest. My favorite of all of them is still First Class. That's my favorite of all the X-Men movies. Yeah.
No, it's a strong entry, that's for sure.
Yep.
So you got good old Charles Xavier and Hank McCoy / Beast are successfully running the school for the gifted, which takes in young mutants who want to learn how to control their abilities and get an education. And it's here we meet the young Jean Grey, played by Sophie Turner, whose telekinetic powers are so strong it concerns Charles. And we also get to know Cyclops, who has just found out that his eyes are now powerful laser beams. In fact, when we were introduced to him thanks to a bully in the bathroom, I couldn't help but think about Midnight Special for just a little bit there.
Yeah.
So we also get to know the rest of the crew here. Raven / Mystique is still saving mutants from being exploited, and she rescues a young Nightcrawler and brings him to the school. Raven has also found out that Magneto is, he's in trouble again, and she wants to go help him with Charles and everybody else. But of course, they are sidetracked because you gotta have a crazy villain here, and this villain comes courtesy of an ancient mutant named Apocalypse, played by a very unrecognizable Oscar Isaac, who rises in Cairo after being trapped for centuries, and he's ready to destroy all the weak humans and take over the world. And of course, Apocalypse can't work alone. He needs his four horsemen by his side. So he ends up recruiting basically the four horsemen. And, we got four powerful mutants that come aboard to assist him, including a young Storm, Cyclops, Angel, and Magneto, naturally. So we got another end-of-the-world scenario here, courtesy of this crazy mutant. And, it's funny, because at one point in this movie, one of the X-Men is walking out of the theater. They're all sort of talking together in a group. And some friends are debating about the merits of Return of the Jedi. And at the end of the conversation, I believe it is Jean Grey who says, "Well, we can all agree that at least the third one is the worst in the franchise." Mm. And I kind of laughed at that, of course, because if you look at the original X-Men trilogy, that's true. Unfortunately, if you look at the rebooted X-Men trilogy, this is kind of also true for X-Men Apocalypse, unfortunately. I don't think it's a terrible waste of time, but it's – It's overlong, overstuffed, with a central villain that's so generic. You don't get really get a sense of evil from him, or any sense of impending doom. And casting Oscar Isaac in this role is really a waste of his talent. In kind of a similar way that reminded me of when they casted Michael Shannon in Man of Steel. They just feel like paycheck gigs and nothing special coming from two of the best actors working today. And even McAvoy and Fassbender aren't given a whole lot to do here. They just seem sidelined, because the story places a lot of focus on Jean Grey and learning not to be afraid of her powers. And I even thought the actress gave kind of a flat performance. But, you know, Bryan Singer, he understands this universe backwards and forwards. He does an okay job, I guess, in keeping things familiar. But he kind of fails in giving us something new and different and exciting like we got from the last two entries in this franchise. I mean, easily the best thing about this film, again, is Quicksilver, who is as funny as he was in the last film and gets a little more screen time. And he has that really nice extended sequence set to the tune of Sweet Dreams. But, you know, I sort of shrugged this movie off when it was over. It feels more like a retread without propelling the story forward. I found it to be pretty much middling, unengaging, and a huge step backwards from the last two films. So I sadly say give this one a pass.
Yeah, I'm with you on this one. Very, very disappointed, especially after the last two. They were so great. And you know, injecting a lot of life into it and bringing in guys like McAvoy, who's one of my favorite actors on the planet, and Fassbender and all these other people, you know, coming in and you know, really changing it up. And this is you described it perfectly when you said it was overstuffed and it's too long. There's just too much stuff going on. And there's too many characters, and none of them are as memorable as they should be. If you're going to jam a movie full of characters, and this seems to be a common problem with the comic book movie in general, is that sometimes, I guess, filmmakers and producers think that the more stuff you cram into a movie, the better it'll be. And that's been a common problem since comic book movies have been invented. I mean, it became a problem with the Batman series. You know, with each progressive movie, I mean, obviously when Joel Schumacher took over, it all fell apart. But, you know, by the time you get to like seven villains in one movie, and that seems to be the case with a ton of movies. That is certainly was the case with Spider-Man 3, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man 3. It's like, you know, you got to tell five origin stories. And so they cram all these mutants in and all this stuff. And it takes Apocalypse forever to pick the four horsemen. You know what I mean? Like, it goes on forever. I'm like, is he still trying to pick who his horsemen are going to be? I mean, and there's like, it's like 70 minutes of the movie is dedicated to that. And now there are things in it that I like. There are like, I'll tell you right now, the one thing the only thing that was memorable to me this entire movie that really stood out for me was Olivia Munn. First of all, I love Olivia Munn. I think she's great. I think she's funny, and I think she's really hot, and she's always great to watch. But for some reason, she really was memorable for me. Like the way I walked out of the movie, and I had pretty much forgotten everything. 15 minutes after watching the movie, I'd pretty much forgotten everything except how cool Olivia Munn is in it. So. But you know, you when you cast guys like McAvoy and Fassbender, you want to give them something to do. They've really got, you mentioned it, Jim, they don't really have much to do here.
No, not at all.
No. And I mean, you're looking at a cast full of really great actors, and you know, the attempts at comedy seemed forced because everything else is so serious, you know, like the villain is taken so seriously. And yeah, and Oscar Isaac, you could have been anybody in that costume. Could have been anybody. And unrecognizable in that costume. It really doesn't give Oscar Isaac much to do at all. It's too long. You know, like a lot of the comic book movies now are too long. And you know, but it seems like, you know, with the release of each comic book movie, you know you're going to be sitting in the theater for almost 2.5 hours. That's kind of a given now whenever you see a comic book movie. And I don't think that's a good thing.
No, not at all.
Now, I liked, you know, Civil War is a different matter. That was a long movie, but it was a good movie, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, it's the exception to the rule, but the Batman versus Superman movie, which is like 2 hours and 40 minutes, one of the worst movies of the year. This is not one of the worst movies of the year. There are some great action sequences and some really cool special effects. Bryan Singer knows how to do that. You know, I mean, he did direct the first X-Men, which is a terrific film. And you know, it's one of these deals where it just has become bloated. It, like many franchises, they think more is better, and that's not necessarily, you know, the case. If you strip stuff back a little bit, you can concentrate more on three-dimensional characters and not waste the talents of tremendous actors. Like Rose Byrne is in this movie, second movie she's been wasted in.
Yeah, in a row.
Yeah. Ty Sheridan, who's one of the best young actors on the planet, he has a couple of moments here and there. And, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, she's kind of taken over the lead position here. And again, not giving a ton to do, and the attempts at humor seemed forced, you know, in order to lighten the mood, which is just so serious and dire. There's too much going on. There's too many characters. It's too long. It's overstuffed. It's not horrible, but I'm not recommending it either. So, all right.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay. I mean, as nice as it is to see Nightcrawler in a thriller jacket, I even think, like, oh, let's just throw in Pac-Man because it's the 80s. You know, it does feel like it's just sort of shoehorned in there, and I don't know. And you're right about Spider-Man 3. You would think that, like, even someone as smart as, like, Joss Whedon for Age of Ultron would have learned from Sam Raimi went through with Spider-Man 3.
That's another one, Age of Ultron, very disappointing movie. So, okay, Jim, hang on.
Okay, we'll
do. Thanks. We got one more movie to talk about, and it's another sequel. How do you figure that one out? All right, we got to take a break here. We'll come back, and we'll tell you all about Alice Through the Looking Glass, and then we'll do some box office for you too. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Tuesday, not Monday. It is Tuesday, and we were off yesterday for Memorial Day. Hope everybody had a great Memorial Day and a great weekend. My dad will be telling a joke because we weren't on yesterday, so he'll tell a Tuesday morning joke, and we're doing the Tuesday morning movie reviews with Jim Leskowski, who's filling in for Colin and Eric, who are taking this week off. They'll be back next week, and we will review the new movies that come out next week with them. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text and your request for Two for Tuesday here. And we will be doing some crazy neighbor stories as well. That's all coming up here on 720 WGN. Let's welcome Jim back to the show to review one more movie. Hey, Jim.
Hello again.
All right, Jim, tell us about Alice Through the Looking Glass.
All right. So since the events in the first film, Alice has become a ship's captain, and upon her return home to England, she learns that her mother is facing a financial crisis and that her former fiancé holds the key, so to speak. And led by a butterfly voiced by the late, great Alan Rickman, Alice returns to Wonderland in order to help an old friend, the formerly Mad Hatter. And poor Hatter, he's fallen into a deep depression brought on by memories of his beloved family. They were all killed when Hatter was a boy, and lately they are all he can think about, and he's just sunk into a deep depression. Determined to help him, Alice listens to, you know, her Wonderland friends and sets off in search of something called the Chronosphere, and that's a time travel device that will allow her to travel back in time and save Hatter's family. She ends up stealing the device, determined to right a wrong, and with her goal on her mind, she does travel back in time, only to uncover the truth behind the petulant Red Queen, who teams up with time and tries to stop Alice before she has a chance to restore order. And, of course, Alice learns that time travel is never as easy as it appears and that consequences for making mistakes with time can be devastating. Okay, well, I have a confession. I have not bothered with the first Alice in Wonderland. Mm. The trailer did nothing for me. I had given up on the collaboration between Johnny Depp and Tim Burton by that time. I wasn't really excited for this installment until I knew that time travel was involved. That's something that will pretty much sell me if I know that, you know, that plays into the film in some capacity. And I also knew that Tim Burton was not on board. The directorial duties this time were passed on to James Bobbin, who directed the Muppets movies, I believe, the rebooted Muppets and its sequel, Muppets Most Wanted. And from what I hear, it's, you know, he takes a more lighthearted approach than Tim Burton did. I'm guessing that from the first one, Burton's sensibilities are there, like the darker nuances, and here it's overall wacky zaniness that you get here. And I will say that, like, the color palette is lush and vibrant. You know, the costumes, the set pieces, the visual effects, everything about that is pretty good. It's pretty good. I mean, the effects are obviously overused, especially towards the third act of this movie. And, you know, I think some of the standouts are, like, you know, Time's Palace, and Time is played by Sacha Baron Cohen. And he's kind of interesting in supporting roles, so I found that, you know, to be interesting at least. But the movie really is just visual eye candy, nothing more. And despite being a fan of the time travel element in pretty much almost any storyline, it adds nothing new or exciting other than the usual, if you alter one thing, then something else gets altered. So it's again, another a lazy blockbuster. I mean, Mia Wasikowska is talented enough to sort of bring some genuine emotion, but on the flip side, you have Johnny Depp at his most kind of over-the-top silly, and that just becomes grating very, very quick. So this whole movie is just a cash grab with no artistic merit on display other than the visuals. I mean, Lewis Carroll's sort of creepiness and surreality is kind of brushed away here, and it becomes exhausting after a while. I honestly don't plan on ever watching the original. And, you know, despite occasionally looking up to see something cool or unique on the screen here, this doesn't warrant the time spent in this world. And it appears that most audiences might agree, since this didn't do so hot at the box office. And good for them, since this really did very little for me.
Yeah, it's I wasn't crazy about it either. I think the first one's okay. I've never been down on the Johnny Depp, Tim Burton collaborations.
Yeah, I think you're more forgiving, especially with, like, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, not just forgiving. I happen to think Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is better than Willy Wonka, and I happen to think Sweeney Todd is, like, one of the most underrated films of the past 10 years.
It's good.
So I'm a fan, but this is just not, you know, this, like you said, it's a cash grab, but it didn't make any cash over the weekend. It only made $28 million over the weekend. I will say this. I saw this in 3D IMAX. And if you're going to see this movie, and I don't recommend that you do, but if you're going to see it in IMAX 3D, because it is visually really gorgeous. And the 3D effects and the IMAX were really a lot of fun. There's not much going on here at all. And the time travel thing, you know, it seemed to me like every time she got into that ball thing and started flying around, they kind of changed the rules. Like, they were never consistent. And if you're going to bring time travel into a movie, at least be consistent in your rules.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
And especially at the very end, it's like, wait a minute, how did this, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but there's something happens. There's a big thing that happens at the end of this film that suddenly gets reversed. And I'm like, what was the, so there was no threat? What?
Mm-hmm.
But again, the highlight of the movie, like the first one, is Helena Bonham Carter. She's hilarious and she's great as that character. It's a fun character and a weird character. She's not having as much fun in this because there's not as much for her to do as there was in the first one. The opening, ship sequence where she's the captain, really beautifully done, but it doesn't add up to anything. So I don't know. It is beautiful to look at. The effects are great, top notch. If you see it in IMAX 3D, that's the way to go. But I'm not recommending it. And Johnny Depp just seems to be doing the Depp thing. So
I've grown so tired of that shtick.
So very disappointing. The two big movies this weekend, both completely underwhelming and not worth seeing. So there you go. All right. Well, next week. What do we got next week? I'm looking forward to Pop Star Never Stops Never Stopping.
Yeah, that could be good.
Oh, I think it's good.
You know, I liked I liked Hot Rod.
So did I. And I love Lonely Island. I think that stuff is hilarious. And there's an unbelievable amount of funny people in it. That's coming out. And then what's the, but there's another, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah. Oh, God.
So, no thanks.
Well, Jim, thanks, man. I appreciate you sitting in with us.
I appreciate it. Anytime that Colin and Eric need a break, it's totally cool.
All right, cool,
it's
man.
An honor.
All right, Jim, listen, have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
Okay,
thanks,
Jim Leskowski, check out nowplayingnetwork.net. We'll take a break, come back, and I'll tell you about the box office winners and losers right here on 720 WGN.
I can always find my Cuban skies and Rosalinda's eyes.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Two for Tuesday, yeah, man. Kathy requested Billy Joel for Two for Tuesday. That's Rosalinda's Eyes. That was back when Billy Joel was good. Remember when Billy Joel was good? I know it's hard to remember, because it was such a long time ago. But he was good at one point. Okay. That's Two for Tuesday, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Nick DiGilio here. And we're going to be talking about crazy neighbor stories. If you had crazy neighbors, loud neighbors, ridiculous neighbors, we would love to hear your stories. Yeah, I've got a couple, definitely. All right, how about the box office for this week? I want to thank Jim again for sitting in. And here are your top 10 movies of the week. Excuse me. Number one, X-Men Apocalypse, which made $65 million. Which, you know, sounds weird, but in this day and age, that's considered a disappointment. You know, like especially a big, you know, big budget comic book movie. If you don't make like $80 to $100 million on your opening weekend, that's considered a disappointment. And I haven't looked up what the other X-Men movies made on their opening weekends, but I don't think. Like the last couple, I think they made more than $65 million. So X-Men Apocalypse made $65 million at the box office over the weekend. I was disappointed in it. Dan, you're a fan of the X-Men series, yes?
I am.
This is a very disappointing one. You haven't seen it.
I have not seen it yet, but just based upon everything everybody say, it seems like it's going the way of the first trilogy where, as you guys mentioned, they're just trying to do too much. They're getting away from the core things and... You know, it's just kind of like, why do we have to make things so complicated?
I know. Well, that's the best way to put it, man, because it's just there's too much stuff going on. They cram too much stuff in it. $65 million for X-Men Apocalypse. By the way, this whole Memorial Day weekend box office has been down this year. And I'm guessing because at least here in Chicago, the weather was pretty unbelievable for the most of the weekend, you know. It was a little overcast, a little rainy on Friday. It rained, right? Was it Friday when it rained? Yeah, that's right. You told me the story on the on the way in. Dan and Dan, why don't you tell the story about you and your lovely wife?
We got away on Friday night. We went to Schaumburg, rented a hotel room, had a very nice dinner, and so it was like 9 o'clock. I'm like, I don't know what we're gonna do because like. Do you want to go see a movie? And she's like, oh, I'm tired. I'm fine with just going back to the hotel room and just going to bed early. And I was like, all right. And so we're driving home, and there's a carnival because it was right by Woodfield, and they sanctioned off a little area for a carnival, and it had like, you know, 8 to 10 rides. There was a big slide. They had the massive tilt-a-whirl, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then they had that big ship. That goes up and down.
Swings back and forth,
swings
right?
Back and forth. Okay. And so Eileen's like, I would really like to go on that. I'm like, I'm fine with that. So we jump on this thing. It starts going. Literally 20 seconds in, torrential downpour. Just massive one. We're the only ride operational. We're still going. Everybody else is like under the like get your goldfish if you throw it in the bucket thing.
Right.
You know, they're hiding underneath that. And we're still going. We step off the ride 4.5 minutes later. Rain stops.
Yeah.
We walk to our car.
That's like, it.
Yeah.
Sopping wet.
Yeah, sopping wet.
That's hilarious. That's I don't mean to laugh, but it's a funny story.
No, it's hilarious. Like literally the 4.5 minutes we are on an open ride.
Yeah. It's just coming down. And it decides to – the sky opens up just for that 4.5 minutes. Like, you know, the Mother Nature knew you guys were going to get on that ride, and that was it. Well,
But for the most part, I mean, the weather was really nice the past couple of days, especially, and I think that probably, you know, bit into the box office. Number two, Alice Through the Looking Glass, which tanked actually, $28 million over the weekend. The first movie made a ton of money when it was released and had a really strong opening weekend, and this really proves to be not a good sign for this movie. $28 million, and I ended up going to see it in IMAX 3D, which is like, you know, an extra $8 or something. So yeah, there weren't a lot of people in the theater. I was really surprised. We went on a Saturday afternoon, my folks and I went on a Saturday afternoon, and there weren't a lot of people. There weren't a lot of people at the X-Men movie either when I went to that.
You had mentioned that the X-Men movie was not available in IMAX, right?
No.
And so, like, that would have...
That would have helped the box office. I didn't see it. I didn't see it in 3D either. It's, you can see it in 3D, but I just saw it in regular D. but, yeah, no, the X-Men movie was not in IMAX, and that would have boosted a little bit of the box office as well. Number three, the Angry Birds movie with $18.7 million, bringing its total up to $66.3 million. That's okay. You know, if it's got legs and it continues to, you know, to stay pretty consistent, I mean, it'll do well. It'll almost make probably like $85 million. Number four, Captain America Civil War, $15 million. Bringing its total up to $372 million domestically and over $1 billion, worldwide. And, you know, the Alice Through the Looking Glass is considered, it's considered a box office bomb, and it's also one of the first Disney movies that has not killed at the box office. But even with the results, though, of only $28 million that Alice Through the Looking Glass made, it's brought Disney's releases to $4 billion. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of money that these Disney movies are making. Even considering that Alice was a bomb, over $4 billion these movies have made. Number five is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, $9.1 million, bringing its 2-week total to 38. Or is it 3 weeks? It's 3 weeks, right? Yeah, it's 3 weeks. Did it come out the same week as? Yeah, it's 3 weeks. This would be week three. So is $38 million total. Not even close to what the first Neighbors made. So again, also considered a disappointment. Number six, The Jungle Book, $6.9 million. That is over $338 million. And number seven, The Nice Guys. I'm so disappointed that nobody went to see this movie. $6.3 million. It's been out for 2 weeks, and it made $21.7 million in 2 weeks. I guess, you know, it wasn't expected to really do insane boffo box office, considering, you know, it's a film noir that takes place in the 70s and it's rated R. Ryan Gosling is a bit of a draw, not huge. Russell Crowe really hasn't been a big box office draw for a long time. So, I mean, they were selling this movie on its style and on the fact that Shane Black did Iron Man 3. They really pushed the fact from the director of Iron Man 3. And Nice Guys is about as far removed from an Iron Man movie as you can get, although it does have that Shane Black sensibility. I was telling you this off the air. Doc Savage, the comic book Doc Savage, is going to come back to the big screen.
Right.
And Shane Black's going to do it.
Right.
And The Rock's going to star.
Yeah.
That could be good.
That seems like a good combination.
Did you see the one from the 70s with Ron Eli?
I did not.
Yeah, it's not good.
I can imagine.
It's not good. I remember seeing, it's 1975 and then 76. So I was 10 or 11 when I saw it. And I found it to be really weird. But Doc Savage is a little weird, right?
Right. It's kind of a weird take on, you know, the big burly man who tries to play hero.
And was it meta before meta was meta? Did it have that kind of sense?
It kind of was meta without trying to be meta, so it became meta.
Yeah.
I think was.
Because I remember seeing the movie, and I remember it being very jokey. You know, like, and with full acknowledgement of the jokiness. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like it totally had its tongue in its cheek. And I don't remember liking the movie, but I thought it was. I just remember the premise. I liked the premise, and I thought some of the stuff was kind of original and weird. Number eight, Money Monster, $4.2 million, bringing its total up to $33 million. Number nine, Love and Friendship, $2.4 million. And then number 10, and it is still in the top 10, comes out this week on DVD. Zootopia is still in the top 10. This movie came out at the beginning of March. The beginning of March. $335 million. And a billion worldwide is another Disney movie that's made a billion worldwide. Still in the top 10. Outlasted by many weeks, the Batman and Superman movie. Nobody saw that coming. Nobody thought that Zootopia would just, you know, knock the Batman and Superman movie around. And it did. Still in the top 10. So, kind of a slow Memorial Day weekend for the box office. With X-Men leading the way with $65 million, even though that's considered underperforming. And the Alice Through the Looking Glass movie really did tank.
It's really interesting, too, because, again, we were talking about this in the car, but they released the X-Men movie to critics weeks ago. And the thinking among people was that, like, they would get the bad buzz out of the way, and by, like, 2 weeks in, people would forget the bad reviews and go see the movies.
Right.
And obviously that didn't quite work out, but it'll be interesting to see what kind of drop they have next week.
It'll be, yeah.
Especially with another big-budget Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie is the big release next week. And I think this thing's going to drop really big. It's going to drop really big. But, you know, I thought Fox did an interest. I've never really thought, you know, let's get the critics to see it 3 weeks early because it's bad. And then once all the social media is done with it for a week and a half, that'll all die down and people will go and see it. Because what killed the second weekend of the Batman Batman Superman movie was that it got horrible word of mouth. It got terrible reviews and horrible word of mouth the opening weekend. And so, you know, I guess Fox thought, okay, we're not gonna make the same mistake that that Warner Brothers did, you know, by releasing this movie on the heels of such bad reviews and really bad word of mouth. So we're gonna wait. We'll screen it really early for the critics. All the bad news will die down, and everybody will go and see it. And it didn't happen. So disappointing weekend at the box office. Slow weekend for Memorial Day. But again, I mean, if you lived in the Midwest, there was some great weather this week, and it was. You know, people clearly wanted to be outside, judging that they had to close Lakeshore Drive down yesterday. People were like, yeah, I got to get outside. I have to get to the beach right now.